Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. This is Saturday, April 19th, 2014. I'm Harley Schlanger and I am your host. In the last several weeks, we've had a recurrent theme coming from Lyndon LaRouche in his forecasting on the war danger and the immediacy of the thermonuclear threat. As many of you remember, the end of January of this year, early February, Mr. LaRouche said by March 1st, we could be on the verge of thermonuclear war. And while few people other than Mr. LaRouche forecast that, what we saw with the developments around Ukraine, the coup that was pulled off by the United States and NATO, the imposition of a Nazi regime with a clear mandate to impose genocidal austerity in conjunction with the International Monetary Fund, and at the same time, an escalation of an eastward march of NATO forces. We, exactly on schedule, were in the face of nuclear war. Now, since that time, we've had a series of developments, most of which, on the surface, have seemed to lessen that danger. But in fact, with the so-called Four Power Agreement 2 days ago, and now the apparent breaking of that because the West will not illegitimize the phony government that was installed in Kiev, we're back where we were before, on the verge of thermonuclear war. Now, one of the points Lyndon LaRouche has made that was part of his forecast is that this was related to the ongoing financial disintegration of the transatlantic nations. And this is something that, number one, very few people understand, and number two, most people are still in an illusion that there's actually been somewhat of a recovery, because that's what they hear in the press, although when they look around them, they can tell that there's no change except for the worse. So today we're going to be talking with someone who has a great deal of experience in investigating the financial situation, who's been working with Mr. LaRouche for over 4 decades and has a lot of unique insights into the situation. Paul Gallagher from the Executive Intelligence Review, and we're going to be looking at this question of the financial crisis, the so-called bail-in policy, and its relationship to this immediate danger of war from the British Empire with the United States as the front force for the war with Russia. So, Paul, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Hi, Harley. Glad to be on.
Good. Now, there's been a lot of talk about the by us about this war, this forecast for the war, and as Lyndon LaRouche has made clear over and over and over, that his forecast was based not simply on the movement of troops, but the relationship of that movement and the coup in Ukraine to the financial situation, the financial collapse ongoing in Europe and in the United States. So why don't we start there? I'd like your thoughts on what that interrelationship is and what is the actual situation economically in the Western world.
Well, look, just as in 1914 and in the 20 years before that, the British Empire proceeded on the basis that it needed to generate a war with Germany, a war entangling Germany in alliances and then a real hot war, and it needed that before the German economy could support a development of Germany to where it would actually challenge and overawe the British Empire economically and militarily. There was a timetable there. It was slower than what we're dealing with now, obviously. It was over a number of years. But everyone in the British establishment around the Prince of Wales in that period, for example, later George VII, understood that war with Germany was a necessity as early as 1905, that it had to be set up and it had to be fought and it had to be won with American support in order to prevent, and that had to be done before Germany could overtake Britain in its economic and related military power. Well, now you have, in the same way, a situation where a war is necessary from the standpoint of the London, the British financial empire. A war is necessary before the very clear decline and near collapse of the transatlantic economies, the European in particular, also the U.S. economy, before that collapse and the relatively galloping progress and growth of the Asian economies produces a situation where Eurasia, in effect, with the big three in particular, India, China, Russia, where Eurasia can dominate politically and economically the development of the 21st century. Before that can happen...
Paul, let me just jump in here because I want you to just elaborate this point because the International Monetary Fund just had their, I guess it's their spring meeting in Washington where they said there's progress being made, things are looking up. The only bleak spot they saw on the horizon was the dangers of slowdown of the so-called emerging markets. So they seem to have absolutely everything backwards, and I'd like you to just explain why you say that this is a collapse of the transatlantic system.
Well, I mean, they were saying with one side of their mouth, everything is okay, there's a little recovery going on. With another, they were continuously and once again lowering their growth forecast for all the European countries, for the EU as a whole, and for the United States, and for the world, for that matter. Although that one in their books is higher because they still rate the growth in the so-called emerging markets higher. But, they even the IMF, which is notoriously bad at this, were forecasting between 1% and 2% growth for the United States and less than 1% for Europe as a whole. So they were joking about recovery. And you have to realize that at the same time, the managing director, Christine Lagarde, and the number two, the U.S. official, were shouting at the top of their lungs at every opportunity that the European Central Bank had to go into a money printing phase on a large scale and do it immediately. In other words, a quantitative easing like the Federal Reserve has done. And they had to do it immediately, according to the IMF, in order to head off unstoppable deflation, which is simply a word that they use instead of collapse, in the banking systems and economies of Europe.
They were talking about a trillion euros of immediate quantitative easing.
Absolutely, yes. They're talking about something on the order, on the scale only of the... what the Bank of Japan has done in the last year, and only on the scale of what the Federal Reserve has done in the last year, which has been the most intense printing of money and buying of securities from the banks, quantitative easing.
And where's that money supposed to come from?
Well, the central banks print it. They actually, in the case of the Federal Reserve, they actually borrow it short term from the banks which they charter. At an interest rate of 0.25%, but this is—it's not that the banks have all this money. The Fed creates reserves for them in the Federal Reserve system, but charges them 0.25% interest to do so. The Fed then uses those reserves, which it has created, so in effect prints money to buy securities from the banks for which it is earning. 3%, 3.5%, depending on what it is. But a lot of these securities are toxic. They're demanding that the ECB do the same thing. But the funny thing is that the European Central Bank itself says, gee, this is difficult. We need the banks and the countries to organize securitization of bad loans so we can buy them. In other words, we don't see the securitized bad loans out there to buy. So get them ready so we can buy them like the Fed has been buying them. These banks, if you take the biggest banks only in the U.S. and Europe, the biggest dozen, between them, you're talking about $30 trillion in assets. This is roughly one-third larger than it was before the crash in 2008.
And these are, you said, the largest 12 banks in the U.S.?
In each, in the U.S., based in the U.S. and based in the Europe combined. Their assets have been blown up by bailouts by one-third in the last five and a half years. They're on the order of $30 trillion, but none of the non-performing loans, the toxic assets that they had at the time of the crash, have been written off or even written down. So on the order of 10 to 14% of the assets in the banking systems of most of the European countries are actually non-performing. They're actually no good. And, you know, this is nothing to say of the new bubbles that they've created during the quantitative easing and bailout period of the last 5 years, like the rebuilding of the bubble in junk bonds, the rebuilding of the bubble in what they call leveraged corporate bonds or CLOs.
Paul, do they count derivatives as part of the assets? Those are not counted as assets.
No.
Derivatives, those are additional obligations above this.
The derivatives exposure of these banks dwarfs the figures that I'm talking about. It's on the order of 20 times larger, 30 times larger than this figure. But it's these bad assets, as we saw in 2008, and it's what has been done with these bad assets, using them as collateral by the banks in the short-term credit markets, the so-called repo markets and so on, in order to generate more debt, which itself goes bad when they go bad. It's that deadly aspect of this. And now they have come and said, okay, we're going to prepare for the next time these banks collapse. And in fact, in the European context, they have begun a stress test, so-called. The European Central Bank is subjecting all the banks finally to what they call an asset quality review. Now, they expect themselves that about 25 of the 130 biggest banks in Europe are going to fail, not only fail the review, but fail, are going to go out of business. And in preparation for this, the European Union adopted March 20th, and actually just 2 days ago, the European Parliament gave a final vote on this, which our supporters there from Italy disrupted, and disrupted in the sense they generated the no votes. They also gave a major presentation on Glass-Steagall in the European Parliament on Wednesday before the vote. But the final vote adopted a policy of full bail-in, meaning that as these banks lose their capital, as they now acknowledge their bad assets and write them down, which means their capital, part of it disappears, maybe all of it disappears, they will generate new capital by taking our deposit money, or if we were European depositors, taking our deposit money, as in Cyprus, defaulting on our bonds if we've bought bonds from these banks, and turning that into claimed new capital from the bank.
But Paul, just on that question, Tom Honig has been very explicit on this when he said that as banks acknowledge bad assets, this is not going to be limited to one or two so-called mismanaged banks, but because of the interrelationship and the trading back and forth of financial paper, letters of credit, things of this sort, that it actually will have what they call contagion. In other words, all of their assets are going to be questionable.
Yeah, he is the vice chairman of the Federal Deposit Insurance Company, and he has been much more explicit and public and frank. He's a supporter of Glass-Steagall, and for that reason has been much more public and explicit about the fact that this full bail-in policy just imposed on Europe, and theoretically in the Dodd-Frank Act as well, that policy cannot possibly work because it is based on a fantasy that a large bank will fail without affecting any of the others. In the era since Glass-Steagall was repealed, and before that many of its regulations were relatively destroyed, since that time these banks have all become so complex and so completely interlinked with their derivatives exposures that, as we saw in 2008, when one goes, even if it's merely an investment bank like Lehman, they're all about to go.
And isn't it also the case that if one bank moves to a bail-in policy where they start taking the assets, or the deposits rather, of their clients, that there might be runs on all the banks because of the recognition that if that's done in one bank, it could be done in any of them?
Yeah, and in fact, even just the discussion of a large bank being in trouble and preparing to bail it in, that is to default on its liabilities and to seize the deposits of its depositors and attempt to call them new capital in the bank. Just the discussion of that could not only hit that bank with runs, but also many other banks with runs. And this is why all the regulators, not only Mr. Honig, who's been much more frank about this, but all of them who are contemplating being in this position regard an attempt to bail in large systemic banks with complete dread and realize that it can't possibly work.
It's really a kind of end game.
It's an end game in which they are sure that it will be attempted, and then at a certain point, as he put it, no Treasury Secretary will say anything except bail them all out. They'll throw up their hands and try again, massive bailouts in order to keep these banks from all collapsing at once, even as they have defaulted on their creditors, even as they have taken their depositors' money, as in Cyprus. I mean, it should be remembered, in the Cyprus case, which became infamous, there was bail-in. 40% of the deposits of the entire banking system there were lost by the depositors.
And this is partly a way that these banks, the biggest banks, assume that they can essentially renege on their debts by writing them down, and especially including as their debts the deposits that they owe to their depositors.
Yes, that's exactly it. They're saying by this system, leaving aside the nonsense about how it's going to spare the taxpayers, they're saying by this system, when our assets finally start to be written off, the ones that have been fictitiously maintained by the central banks now for 6 years, when we finally write them off, we will at the same time default on our liabilities, right? When we collapse one side of our balance sheet because it's toxic, we will at the same time default on the other side of the balance sheet, the liabilities, which are the bonds that the bank has issued and the deposits that people have put into it. And it's not a plan. It's rather a scheme for absolute chaos in a situation which could only be controlled by sheer political force, because you're talking here about imposing deadly austerity. I'll give you one example. The Bankia group failed in Spain 2 years ago. That's not even nowhere near the largest banking group, even in Spain. And yet, in that failure, 300,000 depositors lost an average of $55,000 each. That is massive austerity imposed against the population when big banks do that.
And especially at a point in which governments no longer have money to provide aid to people who have just lost everything.
Right. So, in other words, you need, if you're London, if you're London's friend and puppet Obama, you need the kind of complete control of a political situation which comes after a war. This is the way they think of it. After victory in a war, or a war confrontation in which the Eurasian countries visibly back down to London and to Washington and to NATO. You need that in order to control the effects of this devastating austerity called bail-in, which masquerades as some kind of a plan, but is nothing but the kind of deadly austerity that they're imposing on Ukraine now, for example.
Well, we're talking with Paul Gallagher, one of the economics editors of the Executive Intelligence Review, and Paul has just gone through the fraud of bail-in, the fraud of the argument that there actually is a recovery, and given, I think, a very clear picture of the devastation ahead, because there not only is no recovery, but there's no plan for a recovery. Now, under these circumstances, we're looking at something that, as you say, will get out of control very quickly. And I think that's what Mr. LaRouche is talking about when he says that the people behind this are committed to war. But Paul, talk about why this would end up being a nuclear war rather than some kind of long build-up like a World War One or even a World War Two.
Because their intention with this is either directly through war to drastically reduce the human population, which is the commitment of the royal family, the queen, the prince consort are very open about it, Prince Charles as well. It is, and they have been for years, for decades, very open about the human population in their view being much too large. Their intellectual retainers are very frank about the need to reduce it by any means possible, especially since they failed with the attempt that was made around the Copenhagen climate change conference 3.5 years ago now. Very open that it has to be done by any means. And secondly, you are dealing now with an attempt to face down and humiliate countries which are nuclear powers and which, in addition, not just nuclear powers like, for example, Pakistan is or India is, but rather nuclear powers which have a second strike capability. They can respond after a first nuclear strike. That is, Russia and China have this capability. And Russia in particular, China is rapidly developing it. And therefore, no war can actually result in anything but general nuclear extinction or near extinction because of the nuclear capabilities of the countries involved. And the determination on the part of London, on the part of London's puppets, is force these countries to completely back down, to be humiliated and to agree that NATO, etc., can change any regime in the world that it wishes, can control any regime in the world that it wishes without any resistance. You can't do this when the opponents you're trying to beat down are not just nuclear powers, but powers with a nuclear second strike capability. That is, if you use the nuclear strike against them, they will strike back no matter how you do it, and warfare will be general extinction. So, I mean, this from their standpoint only is accompanied with the fantasy that, of course, Russia and China will back down. They will be rational when we're not rational, and therefore we will get political control of the world in spite of the collapse of our economies.
Now, Paul, you mentioned the austerity regime imposed on Ukraine. The IMF went in as soon as the new government came in. In fact, the whole point of the Yatsenyuk government was a transitional regime to insure the Ukrainian debt over the bodies of the Ukrainian people. And with the coup and the threat of violence from the right sector and others, there was no real opposition in the parliament. But I assume this explains part of the reaction in eastern Ukraine, where, on the one hand, the Russians had offered a very generous deal to help Ukraine deal with the debt crisis. But why would anybody, given what they've seen in Greece with the IMF policy, why would anyone accept an IMF policy? And how does the IMF keep getting away with this?
Well, I mean, in this case, we're not really discussing this in detail of how this government was overthrown and by what kind of forces, but this had been prepared for a long time, including by military training through NATO, of extreme right-wing formations in Ukraine, which has no lack of them and has had no lack of them since World War II, when they collaborated with Hitler and with the SS. These have been used over a period of time. Their interest is in forming and controlling an anti-Russia government in Ukraine. Those right-wing elements really have no other interest. They have no interest in the EU and so forth.
And certainly they don't really have an interest in the living standards of the Ukrainian people.
No, that's why what began supposedly as demonstrations by people who were saying we want an EU lifestyle, and that the irony of that was immediately recognized and attacked by people in the EU countries saying, "What are you talking about? You're talking about entering into a death trap here, if you follow the path that the EU economies are on." This thing very rapidly moved from being supposedly demonstrations on behalf of an EU lifestyle to the coup and then the formation of a government whose prime minister said, "I intend to be the head of a suicide government,"
right,
"which will impose such deadly policies on this country that it will be remembered as the worst government, both the shortest and the worst government that Ukraine has ever had. That's what my government will be." This
and
is
the person
Yats
who said that, Yats, was the one that Victoria Nuland of the State Department, the neocon, insisted had to be the prime minister.
Right. This is going to be the one. It was NATO policy throughout and IMF policy throughout. And it was just barely concealed and really pretty visible to anyone who knew what was going on, that the policy of this coup was one of extreme, extreme cuts in the living standards of people across all of Ukraine. So only in the last couple of days have you seen acknowledgments, interestingly, in the British press, who always watch this very closely and report to their masters on what's happening in the subject countries. Reports that the eastern quote-unquote separatism in Ukraine is actually being fueled by the shock reaction against the austerity measures that the new government in Kiev immediately announced. 40% cuts in people's pensions, for example. Complete elimination of any subsidies that there were for the prices of any consumer necessities, most definitely including natural gas, but also other utilities. In other words, they were going to get the Greece treatment, but even much faster than Greece has gotten it. And they're now just beginning to admit, at least in the British press, that what's happening in the East is in reaction to that.
Well, you mentioned the British press. It's also the case that there's been a renewal of discussion of Glass-Steagall in Britain and the whole question of the British relationship to the EU. First, I'd just like to, if you can, review what happened in the EU Parliament and the discussion around the bail-in, because there was a little bit of opposition, but then also what the opposition looks like in Britain.
Well, yeah, there were 88 votes against the full bail-in policy on Wednesday, against 301, I believe, votes for in the European Parliament. Claudio Morganti, who is a European parliamentarian from Italy, the head of a faction, formal faction in the European Parliament, gave a major speech calling for the restoration of Glass-Steagall and national credit policies instead of the bail-in, in leading that opposition to the vote which took place. But at the same time, in Britain, you have both the Bank of England trying by various manipulations at the last minute to exempt itself from the bail-in, essentially to say, when it comes to London banks, we're going to continue to bail out while all the rest of you have to bail in these banks. We will bail them out. This caused a furor.
So, in other words, Cameron's government is saying that they will go with more quantitative easing instead.
Specifically, they're talking about what they call ELA, Emergency Liquidity Assistance to Banks, the kind of thing that the Federal Reserve was doing all through 2007 and 2008, before Lehman actually went bankrupt. These kind of emergency, large-scale loans to banks, they continued doing them with banks like Citigroup right through the end of 2008 and through 2009. The Bank of England is claiming that despite the adoption of the bail-in policy, which it designed and pushed, that as far as London banks are concerned, there's going to be an exception, and they're going to continue to do emergency liquidity assistance to these banks.
Yeah, the bail-in actually came out of a study originally in the Bank of England, didn't it?
Exactly, yeah. This goes back to 2009.
Yeah.
Bank of England and then the so-called Financial Stability Board, the Bank of International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland. And right now you have the same man heads both the Bank of England, Mark Carney, and the Financial Stability Board in Basel. They make no bones about the fact, the Bank of England makes no bones about the fact that they do not believe that bail-in works at all at this point. They maintain that they believe it will work at the end of this year or in 2016, but they do not believe it will work at all now, and they don't intend to do it for London banks. So this has caused a furor. But at the same time, in the British Parliament, there is very strong support for Glass-Steagall restoration, completely the opposite policy of separating banks and protecting commercial banks in order to put credit through them for economic development. This has very strong support in both the House of Lords and the House of Commons, as it does in the U.S. Congress. The only place it's been introduced over there is in the House of Lords, and it came within, because in the Commons, the government determines whether anything will be introduced at all, no matter how much support it has. But in the House of Lords, it came within 9 votes of being adopted.
Well, in the U.S. now, we've just had the transition from Bernanke, who was a big proponent of quantitative easing, and then at a certain point he started moving toward what he called tapering. Now we have Janet Yellen. There's been a slight tapering further on the quantitative easing, but it hasn't stopped. But where do things stand in the United States on this?
Well, they're going to continue with the reduction in the scope of quantitative easing, but keep in mind it is still very large. It is still larger than, you remember, there was quantitative easing 1 in 2009, early 2010. There was quantitative easing 2 in 2011 and through the early part of 2012. And then quantitative easing 3 and 4, they sometimes call it, during the course of 2013. The 2013 money printing binge was larger than either of the previous ones and still remains larger, even though it has been scaled back now, I think, by a total of 20 billion a month to 65 billion a month. And they're going to continue to reduce it. But they are still pumping a great deal of money out and at the same time promising effective zero short-term interest rates through at least 2016. So they are dealing with the same collapse problem in the U.S. banks. They've done a lot more money printing than the European Central Bank has done, but they're dealing with the same collapse problem. And with the British banks in particular, there is an additional problem, and that is that they have poured money into bubbles in the so-called emerging markets. The Chinese economy is the clearest example. The British and Hong Kong banks have poured $600 billion into real estate speculation and commodity speculation in China. When they talk about the emerging market bubble that has been built up by all this money printing, China is more than a third of it for the world as a whole. And it's British and Hong Kong banks, and they have been riding on top of the real investment that China has been making on the order of $5 trillion in the last 6 years in railroads, in bridges, in water projects, in the building of new cities, in infrastructure generally. They have been investing in real estate speculation and in very perverse forms of commodity speculation, which would take a long time to explain. And that they are now suffering big losses in those speculations, and the money is now that raced into China is now racing out of it because it is suffering big losses due to the policies of the Chinese government to compress and shut down these bubbles. So this has also added tremendous strain to the major British banks and to the U.S. banks that participate with them. The number of bubbles would take a long time to discuss, but the biggest ones which have been restored, which have become even bigger than they were in 2007, are the so-called CLOs, collateralized loan obligations. That means lending leveraged loans to companies that are already completely over indebted and shouldn't be getting any loans at all. That's what CLOs are. And junk bonds, which are simply high interest bond loans to companies with completely distressed credit who don't qualify for credit. So these bubbles are each on the order of 400 to 450 billion, as large as they were when they collapsed or when they contributed to the big implosion in 2007. And this is on top of all of the bad loans, all of the toxic assets that go back to 2007, 2008, which have never been written down, never been recognized. And the idea of bail-in as a scheme was supposed to be, okay, now we're finally ready to write these off, these bad loans off, because we'll make the depositors and the creditors of the banks pay for that write-off by losing their money, and we'll call that money that they lose new capital for the banks. And they did consciously wait until this was politically adopted. It gives you an idea of the need for political control and the motivation for this war policy. They consciously waited until this had been politically adopted to begin to actually subject the banks in Europe to stress tests in which they know they are going to be writing off 10-15% of their assets at minimum, and with many big banks much more than that, and they are expect in 20 or 25 cases the bank's going to fail outright.
Well, Paul, let me switch just a little bit to this question of physical economy, because the obvious point that Lyndon LaRouche has been making, is which you just elaborated quite thoroughly, is that the problem with bailouts, bail-ins, any of these policies, is that they all are premised on a monetarist system, and that, in fact, the monetarist system is the policy of the empire, and it has no intention to allow for physical development, the increases in productivity based on scientific and technological advance. That's written off. Now, one of the other areas that you're a leading authority is on one aspect, and a critical aspect of physical economy, which is actual employment. And I just happened to see a few minutes ago, coming across the ticker, a report that California unemployment rose this month. Now, of course, any month, based on the way they do the figures, the unemployment rate could rise because there are more people out of work. The only question is whether they're looking for jobs or not. What is the situation, to the best of your understanding, with real employment in the United States, starting with the official rate, but then breaking that down and looking at what this means in terms of why we have a bubble rather than a real growth economy?
Well, to make it quick, the best indicators are what they call the participation in the labor force of the population which is eligible to participate. That's the population between the ages of 60 and 65 who are not institutionalized or otherwise incapacitated for work and are therefore eligible to work. What portion of them are either working or looking for it? And then another even more crucial measure is what's called the employment to population ratio, which takes not just the labor eligible population, but the whole population. What proportion of them are either working or looking actively for work? Those measures are at historic lows in the United States, on the order of 63% for the labor market participation, and on the order of 58% for the second. And the astonishing thing is they've continued to go down. For example, during all of 2013, month by month, they continued their secular trend down, even as we kept hearing about recovery and we kept hearing about jobs being created.
But the Obama administration is trying to say that that's a good sign because people are volunteering to leave the labor force.
Yes, there are great debates that it's really just that all the baby boomers are finally reaching the age when they can retire or they could retire early, and they're deciding to retire because life will be better if they retire. This is nonsense.
But it's not as though their jobs are being replaced by young people because youth unemployment is off the charts.
Yeah, sure. It's completely belied by the fact that the age group with the highest participation in the labor force and with the highest employment to population is the age group between 55 and 64. So those are, in fact, the people who have kept working to the greatest degree. It's the population between 16 and 35, which is by far the most unemployed and the least even attempting to find work. And the employment to population ratios in those parts of the population are in the very low 50s%.
And what does that mean for the future?
It means that nothing is being done to develop the economy and that nothing is being done to develop the actual scientific and technological skills of the younger generations, because they are losing a great deal of their most creative and most productive work life before they even enter the workforce, before they even manage to find any work.
And how are they going to become consumers then if they don't have jobs?
But we have, at the same time, this tremendous physical problems of infrastructure facing us in the U.S. economy. And, you know, you're in the middle of Keisha Rogers' campaign in Texas, and also Mike Steger's campaign out in California, which are focused, in addition to getting rid of Obama, are also focused on how the drought can be ended in the face of an unbelievable passivity on the part of Congress, including even congressmen and women from California, from Texas, from the most drought-affected areas, are simply not talking about doing anything about what is likely to be a decades and decades long drought and get worse and worse over a very long period of time, where we've already lost, in the California case, I think nearly a million of the 10 million agricultural acres in California
have at least a 10% shrinkage
are out of production, and the prices of everything produced there in the food area are going up and are projected to go up now in the next 3 months very rapidly as a result of that. No planning, not merely that people are not yet talking about the full solution in terms of the North American water and power lines, but they're not talking about anything because of the tremendous demoralizing effect of this miserable Obama administration, particularly on the Democratic Party, so that they have become as inert in regard to serious investment in the economy as the stupid Republicans are. So these are two very serious problems. They come from the wastage of the labor force and the inability of the country to decide to tackle the most important infrastructure problems. They're associated also with the fact that these banks don't lend money. They have huge amounts of money printed for them, and their deposits have increased tremendously by $2.2 trillion in the last 5 years. That means by not quite a third, but more like 28%.
Well, where's most of that money going? Because one of the things that you had did a report on an interview the other day with William White, former chief economist of the BIS, and one of the things that he mentioned is that the problem for the banks is not liquidity, because they have liquidity, but solvency, because the liquidity is there to back huge volumes of worthless debt. But when banks are getting money from the Federal Reserve or the European Central Bank, what do they do with it?
Well, he points out that they use a lot of that money that's printed for them to what he calls evergreen their bad assets. In some sectors, it's called extending and pretending. They use it to roll over debt which can't be collected, assets which have gone bad, and to keep them evergreen by the financial support of the money printed by the Federal Reserve, so that they and course, for years now, the Federal Reserve has been directly buying these assets from them, which not only props up the value of the ones they buy, but of the ones they don't buy.
So to just put this really directly, at a point in which it's evident that infrastructure investment, investment in new technologies, nuclear energy, thermonuclear fusion, all these areas, NOAPA, are starving for cash, the cash that exists, or the it's not even cash, the money on the computers that exists, is backing up the worthless assets that you were talking about at the beginning of the program.
Yeah, and the solution in, at every point in the United States history, when solutions were found to crises like this, they had nothing to do with the amount of money that appeared to be circulating around. At the time when Hamilton formed the first national bank, the United States not only had not a currency, it also was awash in unpayable debts at every level, and was really truly bankrupt. And that, as President Washington said of what Hamilton did, it appeared to be a miracle to those who watched the effect of the credit flowing into the economy, where no money appeared to exist at all and no capacity to borrow any just a few years earlier. It was created by a national credit policy through a national bank. When Lincoln did the same starting in late 1861, when his administration did the same with the greenback policy, you again had a government which was unable to borrow money effectively as the Civil War began. It was being forced to pay 12% and more in attempting to float bonds on the Wall Street and European bond markets. And it was facing immense needs for funds which it couldn't meet. And it did this with the policy that became known as the greenback policy. And again, because that credit was created for purposes which were absolutely essential to development of the nation, going way beyond the fighting of the war to preserve the Union, but also the development of the railroads, the steel industry, the state colleges, the educational and industrial infrastructure. This was the most successful currency policy that the United States has ever carried out, in terms of the impact that it had in the next 30, 35 years, making the United States the leading industrial power in the world, coming from that starvation situation at the beginning of the Civil War.
But to do that today, you'd have to start with, as LaRouche has emphasized, and as Keisha and Michael Steger have made as a central theme of their campaigns, you'd have to start with Glass-Steagall, because you have to end the policy of evergreening, end the need to keep these huge volumes of a debt bubble on the books of the bank. You'd have to clean that out, and Glass-Steagall is the way to do that.
Right, and it's also the way to end the policy of printing, of the Federal Reserve printing money in order to provide liquidity and capital to these banks, which in exchange for no lending. This credit policy has been done successfully before, because it has combined, it has linked directly special issues of U.S. government debt with large-scale issues of U.S. government federal credit for directed purposes, for purposes which went through the banking systems, yes. That's why you must do separation of the commercial banking system and protection of that system only, and let the rest to fail. Let the rest to go as bankrupt as it is right now. All the investment banks, all the hedge funds and so forth, let it, all of Wall Street, let it go. Bring it down, but protect the commercial banking system under the Glass-Steagall principle, because this national credit should go through a banking system in order for it to be most effective.
Paul, where are we now? You do a lot of work in the Congress. Where are we now on Glass-Steagall? We've had bills sitting there in the House and Senate. The situation is continuing to worsen. I think some of the sponsors of the bill are aware of the problem. Where does it stand now, and what's the obstacle?
Well, the obstacle is Wall Street. We've seen that very strongly demonstrating. It's demonstrated in the last 9 months. It's been a pitched battle in which everybody who has moved for Glass-Steagall, either in Congress or in a state legislature around the country, has been directly confronted by bank representatives of the large Wall Street banks and threatened with their own career and also with the jobs in their state and credit war against financial warfare against their state if they went forward with the Glass-Steagall. And it has also been strongly and actively opposed by the Treasury, by Obama, by the Obama administration, mainly through the Treasury, in pressuring, which is why with support ranging at about 100 members of the House and a dozen members of the Senate, it has not been able to break above that. There are some of these members who are going to continue to campaign publicly for it, especially in the Senate. But I think that the way that it will break out to the next level is to link it very firmly to the need for the North American water and power and other infrastructure investments, the need for a national credit policy, which becomes more and more evident in the physical economic collapse. Understanding banking is one thing, being able to, and that's rare enough among elected officials, understanding it and also being able to fight the most powerful banks on Wall Street is another thing, and that is much more rare among elected officials. They have to really take hold of a physical economic policy to prevent the collapse of the economy, to prevent the collapse of food production, prevent the takeoff of hyperinflation in commodities. They have to take hold of a policy to do that. Glass-Steagall is a part of that.
Well, we heard from Elizabeth Warren this last week at a town meeting in Massachusetts where she was confronted by LaRouche organizers, where she said after the recess they're going to take it up. But I think I've heard that before from some of these sponsors. What can the listeners do? I mean, we've been talking about this for a very, very long time, but it's crucial now that we use the momentum from Keisha's campaign to push this thing through. What can people do to move the Congress?
Well, I think from the organizing that you are very day-to-day involved in with the campaigns, the answer is very clear to you. What they can do is mobilize to throw the president out of office. That is the kind of shock that will open up policy changes and the kind of economic policies that are needed. You have the Republican Party having fallen into utter stupidity fallen into the idea that the stupidest possible campaign between now and 2016 will gain them the House, the Senate, and the White House all together by essentially doing nothing that would require even the slightest exercise of human intelligence. They will come into all of this tremendous political benefit. So, where do they get that idea? They get it from the hatred of Obama, which is at the same time sapping away the Democratic Party's constituencies because of the dislike of him is so widespread among Democratic constituencies. So, it's not new to us, but that strike, that change, would be the one that changed everything. And I think the thing that people that are listeners and supporters have to do is actively mobilize, organize with us to get the president out of office.
Well, at this point, we're looking at a situation where, because of this situation that we've been discussing for the last 50 minutes or so, we are on the verge of war, and I think you made very clear that connection. So the real issue then is what holds people back, and I think this probably is a topic for another program, but what we've seen is the very great success of a strategy of the British Empire to convince Americans that there's no such thing as a British Empire, so they don't know what's actually oppressing them. And they start blaming everything from racial and ethnic groups, religious groups, abortion issues, social issues, and they miss the fact that all of this is the policy of an empire. So I wonder if you can just comment on that as we're down to about 5 minutes.
Well, we've always had a policy embedded in what Americans are able to think about and embedded in our history, which is the absolute opposite of the British policy. You know, the British financial center of London still rightly considers itself the financial center of the world and the greatest financial power in the world, and it is that. And they are planning for the collapse of the world economy, country by country, as well as overall through war confrontation. You had the British publication The Economist 7 years ago now publish a full scenario for a war confrontation with Russia over a government crisis in Ukraine. You probably remember this, Harley. They published this in July of 2007, a fairly detailed account of how an Obama administration, and they were also saying it would be an Obama administration, even though he was not even the leading Democratic candidate at that time, an Obama administration would face down and humiliate Russia over a government crisis in Ukraine, which would occur over the desire of Ukraine to enter the European Union. So this policy of destruction, we know what entering the European Union is meaning for Ukraine. This policy of destruction is very conscious, destruction of the economies of other countries, very conscious on the part of the British Empire and always has been. And we only have to look at what our country in its best periods has been able to do to understand that we were operating on a different cultural as well as economic perspective known back then in the 19th century as the American system, and that we were able to use that system to generate credit in ways that the British Empire forbids, absolutely forbids, by currency boards and every other way, means in its history, forbids countries to use to generate national credit, which goes directly into building up the national infrastructure and productive power of those countries. We've done it in the past, and we've had to fight wars directly or in disguise against the British Empire repeatedly to do that. And we still have, I think, you know, LaRouche's view, despite the tremendous inroads against the U.S. population culturally by decades of counterculture and decades of growing unemployment and misemployment and underemployment, we still have the capacity to restore that American system. You can't do it without directly fighting, and in this case, this means, again, the puppet of the British Empire who's currently occupying the White House has to be thrown out.
Well, and given that not doing that means a likely descent into nuclear war, and if for some reason we would survive or not get into a nuclear war, we have the hell of IMF austerity, which is really Nazi-style genocide. I think it's time that people draw the conclusion that it's a lot easier to stand up and organize people to change the way they think than it is to accept the consequences of not getting rid of Obama. So, Paul, I thank you very much for your time today and your insights. I think people need to listen to this and think about it and realize that this is the background to LaRouche's forecasting, and that the fact that Lynn has been so accurate in his forecasts, while everyone else has been so obviously flawed and fraud, that it's time that we take the benefit of LaRouche and his method and apply it to policy today. And that means fighting the British Empire. So, Paul, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
And for those of you listening, we'll be back next Saturday at 3 p.m. for the LaRouche Show. This will be on the LaRouchePub.com website, available for you to get your friends to listen. And let's mobilize to get this impeachment finally underway. Thank you.